to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. I'm on location. In fact, today just completing a special retreat as a fundraiser for many of the listeners from our sister station where I've been for 42 years, WBAI. Today, we're going to take a look at the latest on processed meats and zinc, preventing cancer, and some hard-hitting, interesting, and completely valid explanations of why vaccination is not immunization with Roseanne Lindsay. Also, white privilege from an Asian perspective. And if time permits, Heather McDonald. How much more delusional can university students get? Plus, we have a guest today, a very distinguished guest, in the second part of our program, who'll be talking about, well, what it means to be a neoliberal society, what we gain, what we lose, and why we are caught in this constant back and forth of groups that are vying for power over us. So we'll talk with our guest, who is Professor William Eggington. Now, he is the Decker Professor of Humanities and Director of the Alexander Grass Humanities Institute at Johns Hopkins University. So it'll be a nice, interesting discussion of neoliberalism. And from my perspective, I believe it's created a culture of identity politics and inequality and a loss of civic responsibility on our college campuses. So we'll see what he has to say. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing, and we're going to share this with you now. The Cancer Research Institute of the United Kingdom took a look at a lot of studies, especially women who ate high levels of processed meat were far more likely to develop cancer compared to those who ate small amounts. Now, previous findings from the World Health Organization said that processed meats cause cancer. And as such, this study supported previous findings. The new study mentioned that those eating meat in the amount that they do, you can really increase your risk of cancer. Now, mind you, that's without alcohol or sugar, or environmental pollutants, or stress, any of the other normal cause of cancer, so they all work together against you. That is a big deal. So about 23% of all breast cancers are preventable. I believe it's higher, but that's what they came up with. So if we could prevent breast cancer by encouraging women to stay away from all processed meats, not only would it help save them from breast cancer, but colorectal cancer as well. And it would help save the environment. Because right now, one of the major causes of global warming is methane from animal production. And so if we stopped eating meat, we wouldn't have all the animals. If we didn't have all the animals, we wouldn't have all the methane. This was published in the International Journal of Cancer. I believe it was around 30 years ago. I mentioned some studies on modified citrus pectin, P-E-C-T-I-N, pectin. Now a new study from Miami Children's Hospital has come out and published in the British Medical Journal of Complementary and Alternative Medicine showing that modified citrus pectin, you can buy it in any health food store, packs a powerful immune punch. And the study used human blood samples to demonstrate the ability of the modified citrus pectin to very significantly induce and enhance the benefits of T cytotoxic cells in human natural killer cells. Now, you need human natural killer cells in order to kill cancer cells. And so what are called NK, or natural killer cells, killing activity was demonstrated in live leukemia cancer cells, uncovering yet another mechanism of this powerful anti-cancer action. And immune researchers at Dharma Biomedical and the Department of Pathology at Miami Children's Hospital are excited. because here's something that's natural, comes from citrus, and it goes into the bloodstream, not just stays as most fiber does in the intestine, and it has the potential to help stop viral diseases like the common cold, upper respiratory tract infections like a viral infection of the lungs, and the flu. So this is really significant. Modified citrus pectin. And it's healthy. Also, they found in a separate study that the B complex can protect against diabetic kidney disease. This is from the Anshams University in Egypt. And we have a lot of people suffering from kidney disease, and this was at the 57th Annual European Society of Endocrinology meeting, and they laid all this out there about the B-complex, a simple, inexpensive B-complex. I would suggest a 25 milligram a B-complex per day. So one more way that's natural, non-toxic, to help diabetics. And this was also type 1 diabetes as well, so that's good. From the University of Texas in Arlington, they have a study on zinc and say zinc is cancer's worst enemy. In effect, this mineral is key to preventing cancers, and that's important for all of us. So consuming zinc in your diet or as a supplement like 15 milligrams, we rarely think about that. Unless it's cold season and you want to help prevent a cold, then zinc can make a big difference. But this isn't about a cold. It's far more serious. Researchers at the University of Texas have discovered the important role zinc can play in preventing cancer, especially esophageal cancer. And although past studies have indicated zinc has a protective effect on the esophagus when it comes to cancer, this even made it more clear. So what we have now is one more nutrient that's inexpensive, easy to get, and we should be taking it because it could help prevent cancer. Also, a study out of University of Southampton showed a growing body of research suggests that our food choices are guided by hidden biases. So then the question that I have is this. Does male social anxiety deter vegetarianism? I remember once I was upstate at the Fertiller Farm, and the guy came up. I'd never met him, and I was out there in the garden, and it was in the middle of the week, and he said, I was told by someone in New York that you'd be here this week, and he said, I'd like for you to help me with my diet because I'm going to be training for a professional fight. And I'm going to be, you know, right up there, highly ranked. I won't mention his name. And so I sat with him and talked about his diet. And I said, you are aware that you can gain additional strength without eating meat. You can do it through protein. He said, well, I heard that. I find it hard to believe. I said, well, that's because of conditioning. We've been led by our dietitians and then home economics teachers to believe that we have to have certain things 2 to 3 times a day, like dairy and bread for our carbohydrates and meat. And that's why the average person in America grew up believing that you had to have bacon and eggs and milk and toast for breakfast and some kind of sandwich. Where I came from, it was generally a grilled cheese sandwich with Campbell's soup, a tomato soup, and a glass of milk for lunch, and then some kind of meat for dinner. Generally, a pot roast was once a week, and fish was once a week, and steak was once a week, but they could give liver also. And no one questioned it. And it's understandable, because after all, it was hard to wrap your mind around that anybody could conspire, intentionally or not, to give us something that would actually not help us, but could harm us. And the scientific literature at that time actually showed how dangerous sugar was. In fact, I found studies in 1906 in the British Medical Journal showing the problems they were having with sugar at like 6 pounds a year consumption. We're over 200 pounds now when you consider how much the average person who's consuming sugar consumes. You might have an average of every person in America, whether it's a baby or a diabetic that takes no sugar or a person that likes sugar, and they'll say it's 140 pounds a year, but I don't need any sugar. I know many other people don't need any sugar, so someone's eating our sugar. So the people actually consuming sugar are consuming a lot more than the national average. And they were having problems back then. But still, when I came to New York, people didn't believe that they'd play politics with our health. There was just some sacred cows you didn't touch. Nutrition was one of them. Cancer was another one. Heart disease was another. And so people continued to eat all this food. And so he said he was eating about 300 grams of sugar, of protein a day. And I said, whoa, that amount of protein your body can't store. And you can only use about 30 grams at a time. So 90% of what you're taking in, your body's not able to process properly. And the byproduct is ammonia and urea. So that's creating a bad reaction on your kidneys. It can create brain fog. And so we had this long conversation. And I then invited him to lunch. And I made him, as I do every day, a really nice vegan lunch. And he enjoyed it. He said it tastes good and it was filling. And then he left. And later, he did fight in the world championship. And he lost. And it was interesting because he hadn't gone the vegan route at all. In a later conversation, he said he thought about changing his diet, but he was afraid that if he didn't take the meat every day, that he would be iron deficient and he would be weak. No, I can show you all kinds of athletes who are extremely strong. Mr. Olympias, Mr. World, great athlete, Carl Lewis, Edwin Moses. Yeah, these are vegans. Yeah. So, Sid Howard, one of the greatest senior and master milers in history. Thelma Wilson. Louise Nottage, one of the greatest female athletes in American history. These were all vegans. So, this study done at University of Southampton said that when it comes to race, gender, and class, and even height and hair color, research shows we make value judgments based upon arbitrary assessments, and the same holds true for food. And it comes down to this. A lot of men believe that if they went vegan, they would be demasculinizing themselves. It's a myth. But that doesn't mean it doesn't stick in their mind. So, that's important. So men, get over the idea that somehow by being vegan, you're being feminized, because you're not. According to the latest study from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, they draw upon what are called chemical signatures left on human bones from thousands of years ago to post a connection between meat eating and the rise of paternity and patriarchy. And during the Neolithic periods, starting around 10,000 years ago and coinciding with the rise of agriculture, bone analysis indicate that men and women ate the same diets, making them more or less equal standing. According to the Queens College, City University of New York professor, Kate Pinachka. And so we have a long history of people thinking if they eat a certain food, it will affect them. So in any case, whatever the origins of the maleness of meat myth, all the evidence suggests that the connection between meat and animal products is not only real, but has determined consequences for human and ecological health. And that means that the planet is warming, our health is depreciating, diseases are proliferating because of the meat that you're eating. From the National University of San Agustin in Peru, a protein found in pea powder effectively kills common bacteria strains. A purified protein from peas called pisum, P-I-S-U-M, Sativum, S-A-T-I-V-U-M, was evaluated to have more than 120 amino acids, all of which would together to improve the immune system. And the effect was observed to have a profound in the prevention and treatment of infections caused by the common bacteria strains of E. coli and S. aureus. So, when I've been suggesting that you have your protein from brown rice, split pea, well, there you have it. We didn't even know this, that it was that effective, that the split pea protein can kill off common bacteria. And finally, tarragon, as a supplement, can make healthy women be more balanced in their weight. This is Louisiana State University. And just, it's great as a flavoring agent. I really like it, especially in brown rice. And that's the latest on health and healing today. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay with us. Now, I want to bring you a few more issues concerning the environment. According to EcoWatch, there are 8 world cities that could be underwater as the oceans rise. Now, we know that global temperatures are on the rise, and we know we're above 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is above and the ideal temperature limit set by the Paris Agreement on global sea level rise will be about 40 centimeters, approximately 15.7 inches. And so if the temperature goes above 2 degrees Celsius, which everyone I've spoken to says, yes, it's going to happen a lot sooner, that means that the sea's going to rise by at least 50 centimeters, and 50 centimeters is about 20 inches. But we don't know when that'll happen. And all these people saying, well, in 100 years, it's nonsense. It's happening now. If you don't think global warming is real, why don't you speak with the people in North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, California, Oregon, North Dakota, Colorado, and all of them have been devastated by fires and other extreme weather events. So here are the cities that I wouldn't move to in the future or invest in. Jakarta, which is in Indonesia, and it's got a lot of increase in water coming in there. In fact, it's one of the world's fastest sinking cities, and much of the sinking is due to the digging of illegal wells to access groundwater, since surface potable water options are too polluted to be safe. And more than 97% of the city is covered in concrete, and the groundwater is not replenished by rain and rivers, so the city is also sinking due to the weight of the buildings. Bangkok, which is in Thailand, in Bangkok faces a similar problem of skyscrapers pushing down on water-depleted soil. And that's not good. So you're going to have fractures and structural problems on all those giant buildings. Also, Lagos, which is in Nigeria. And Lagos is built on the coast and incorporated as a series of islands, and poor drainage worsened the impact of devastating floods. And some estimate that at just 20 centimeters, which is approximately 8 inches, of sea rise could render 740,000 people across Nigeria homeless. And Lagos also faces the problem of excessive groundwater extraction. And then you have Manila, which is in the Philippines. Manila is also sinking due to groundwater extraction at a rate of 10 centimeters or approximately 4 inches per year. And that's 10 times the rate of climate change sea level rise. And another problem is this extensive rice fields, which consume more water than other crops and increase flood risk when illegal fish ponds are built in tidal channels. And Dhaka, which is in Bangladesh, is sinking at a very substantial rate. Shanghai in China is another major city sinking under the weight of its own development as groundwater extraction and increased building causes it to subside. It's also losing sediment that would naturally protect it against its rivers and that are dammed or because it used for building materials. And then London, England. And during the last ice age, glaciers pressed down on Scotland, causing the south of the United Kingdom landmass to rise. Now the glaciers have melted. Scotland is rising at a rate of 1 millimeter per year, and the south of England, including London, is sinking. The Thames Barrier, opened in 1984 to protect London from a 1-in-100-year flood, was expected to be used 2 to 3 times a year. It is currently used double that, 6 to 7 times a year. And finally, Houston, Texas, the third largest city in the United States, or third or fourth. And Houston sits on the Buffalo Bayou and is naturally flood-prone for that reason. It's also a sinking due to groundwater extraction, and ironically, from the extraction of oil and natural gas from the ground beneath it. And the Houston-Galveston area has already lowered by 3 cubic meters. That's 105 inches, and the Northwest is sinking by 2 inches. Now, we're filming all across the United States right now for a new documentary, and you can see it, and the effects are devastating. Not a word in any newspaper or media, but there are over 1 million people living around Houston who are poor, and they don't have the benefit of the skyscrapers or the elevated exclusive properties. And when it flooded with over 21 trillion gallons of water, the most it's ever poured down at one rain through the hurricane that stalled last year, about a year ago now, all that water caused all the refineries to spill out onto the ground. That stuff is volatile. Those chemicals are bad for you, and they don't go anywhere. They go into the soil. The trouble is the soil there is not a loamy soil, it's clay. So there's no place for it to go because the clay acts as a cap and seals the water from going deeper. So people have been living in and that terribly toxic environment. And no one's doing a darn thing about it. That's just one of the issues that I feel are important that we're not dealing with and we should. And by the way, another one from Climate News Network, Tim Radford, is the frozen Arctic is moving seaward in hectic melts. And one trapped in a Russian ice cap north of Siberia, the frozen Arctic is moving fast, racing in decades from meters to kilometers a year. So satellite images have revealed a dramatic change in Russia's frozen Arctic, an ice cap that once crept almost imperceptibly across the barren rocks of October Revolution Island. Not now. All ice, even when permanently frozen in the bedrock, moves. And it's moving, and it's melting, and methane is being released. And yet we're not talking about it like it's not important. It is important. And I'm now going to take you over to an audio clip. I think it's important. We'll play a little bit of it, the whole clip, which is 27 minutes. We'll put on PRN.fm. You can listen to it. This is Roseanne Lindsay talking about why vaccination is not immunization. And we've been told time and again, get your immunization. No, you mean get the vaccination. And they say no immunization because vaccine is immunization. No, it is not. Listen to what she has to say, please.
Today, neurological and autoimmune disorders are skyrocketing. Epilepsy, autism, food allergies, asthma, type 1 diabetes, leukemia, ADHD, speech delays, tics, high-pitched screaming, SIDS, lupus, MS. All of these are listed as possible side effects to toxic vaccine ingredients. Now, ignorance is no excuse in the age of information. Don't let those who are ignorant dominate you. Let them go. Seek out greater understanding and do yourself a favor. Be informed.
During this segment, we'll discuss a short history of vaccination, the rise of disease through viral vaccine shedding, aluminum adjuvants in vaccines and the rise of autoimmune labeled, the dangers of nanoparticles of heavy metals in vaccines. And we'll ask the question throughout, is vaccination equal to immunization? And if not, what is it? So let's begin. The practice of variolation is centuries old and is mentioned in 10th century Chinese and Indian documents dated around 1000 AD. During medieval times, many herbal remedies and cold remedies were used to prevent or treat smallpox. Survivors of smallpox became immune to the disease for life. Variolation was the first method used to inoculate an individual against smallpox or variola, with material taken from a patient or an inoculated individual in the hope that a mild but protective infection would result. The first smallpox vaccine was introduced by Edward Jenner in 1796. However, not long after, the smallpox vaccine began to cause smallpox epidemics. Reports of deaths resulted from side effects of the vaccine, including a skin disease known to be worse than smallpox. By 1855, it was obvious the vaccine was not working. But Massachusetts instead created laws mandating smallpox vaccination after the largest outbreak at the time. Even so, the epidemics continued, showing that the vaccine had no effect at all. And records show that more people died in the 20 years after the strict Massachusetts vaccination compulsory laws than in the 20 years prior. Here's the data again, showing smallpox mortality after compulsory vaccination compared with scarlet fever mortality, which follows a similar trend. Dr. Robin Cosford says, scarlet fever, which is an infectious disease caused by streptococcal bacteria, was in existence in the same sort of levels at the same time as whooping cough, measles, polio, etc. And we do not vaccinate against scarlet fever. We never have vaccinated against scarlet fever. And interestingly, the incidence of scarlet fever has dropped off, paralleling the drop in whooping cough, polio, and so on. In fact, the first study between vaccinated and unvaccinated people took place in 1889 after 45 years of the government's smallpox vaccination program. Author Alfred Wallace used the government's own data to show that vaccines were useless and dangerous. Two of his conclusions showed that, one, the severity of smallpox as a disease had not been mitigated by vaccination, and two, several inoculable diseases had increased to an alarming extent coinciding with enforced vaccination. Interestingly, Wallace showed that other diseases for which there were no vaccines were decreasing at this time due to improved sanitation, hygiene, and nutrition. Later, vaccination also seemed to increase polio and other diseases, showing that vaccination is not immunization. Today, the evidence continues to pile up with increased adverse effects, particularly in children and babies. We see high infant mortality statistics in areas that have the highest vaccination rates. Are vaccines causing a rise in disease that are now common and rising around the world? The Council on Foreign Relations plotted a map of outbreaks for all common infectious diseases, measles, mumps, and whooping cough, and found that these outbreaks were highest in the most vaccinated populations. Oops. What else is increasing? Let's first look at sudden infant death syndrome known as SIDS. The science shows that diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, or the DTaP vaccine is linked to causes of sudden infant death syndrome. GlaxoSmithKline, the manufacturers of the hexavalent vaccine, disclosed in a confidential report to the regulatory authority that about 72 babies died within 20 days of receiving Inforex Hexa. They reported that the deaths of these children were due to sudden infant death syndrome and sudden unexpected death syndrome, unrelated to vaccination. However, an Italian court ordered that this study be made public, and it's now available on the internet. 97% of deaths following this vaccine occur in the first 10 days. In 1975, the Japanese raised the minimum age of vaccine from 2 months to 2 years and saw the rate of SIDS drop to zero. There's also a link between the Hep B vaccine and type 1 diabetes. The incidence of type 1 diabetes in the 0 to 19-year-old age group has been studied since 1982 in Christchurch, New Zealand. And a rise in type 1 diabetes was known to occur in 1989 after the initiation of a Hep B immunization program. The Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, also published data in 1998 supporting a link between timing of vaccination and an increased risk of type 1 diabetes after 2 months of age. You can find this in the Journal of Pharmacoepidemiology and Drug Safety, Volume 6, from 1998. These studies show that Hep B vaccine is associated with type 1 diabetes, autoimmunity, and childhood obesity. Now, obesity, or the accumulation of fat tissue, is the body's natural response to contain and encapsulate heavy metals and chemicals in the body to keep it away from the organs. Your body knows. The MMR vaccine is linked with autism, and multiple vaccinations are linked with immune disorders. This short list represents just some of the hundreds of studies that now exist showing a vaccine autism connection, primarily related to ethyl mercury, fetal tissue cells, mycoplasma, all in vaccines now, as well as an 8.3 times increased risk if the mother is injected while pregnant with mercury-laced vaccines. But wait, there's more. As we see from this association between glyphosate use and a rise in autism, we know that glyphosate is a pesticide sprayed on crops that's now found in all vaccines. This was tested independently by moms across America. At this rate, MIT researcher Stephanie Seneff predicts that 1 in 2 children will be autistic by the year 2025. Dr. Seneff says that glyphosate could easily be present in vaccines due to the fact that certain vaccine viruses, including measles and the MMR and the flu shot, are grown on gelatin derived from ligaments of pigs fed heavy doses of glyphosate in their GMO foods. Glyphosate destroys our beneficial bacteria, and we are 10 to 1 more bacteria than human cells. There's also a link between multiple sclerosis and the Hep B vaccine in the U.S., as well as in France, where there was a sudden rise in the number of cases in MS after the World Health Organization began a mass vaccination program between 1994 and 1997, where 20 million French people were vaccinated. We know that the DTaP, IPV, and Hib vaccines are associated with seizures on the day of the first two vaccines given at 3 months and 5 months. The Journal of Pediatrics shows an increased risk of seizures 7 to 10 days after vaccination with MMR administered at the recommended ages of 12 and 15 months of age. What is going on? Well, vaccines contain toxic heavy metals. Not only is mercury still in vaccines, going unlabeled for the most part, but aluminum is now added as an adjuvant to hyperstimulate the immune response by increasing antibodies. Aluminum is a neurotoxin. Currently, children are getting 17 or more shots containing aluminum. This quadruples the amount given since the 1970s. We see aluminum in the Hep A, Hep B, DTaP, MMR, Hib, pneumococcal, Gardasil, as well as the flu vaccines that are now mandated annually for children in many states, as well as healthcare workers. These antibodies don't appear to actually improve long-term immune responses to infections and disease, which is what most people imagine vaccines will do. In fact, there's now a proven direct connection between aluminum and vaccines and autoimmune disease called ASIA, or autoimmune inflammatory syndrome induced by adjuvants. Remember, aluminum is a neurotoxin like arsenic, cadmium, lead, and mercury that destroy nerve tissue, and we're injecting it directly into the blood. Several studies confirm this association in the medical literature. Besides aluminum, other triggers include infections from bacteria and viruses that are found in vaccines. Autoimmune disease also occurs due to genetic susceptibility, which is triggered by microbial antigens, as well as suppressed immune systems. And now babies coming into this world have a weaker constitution, as mothers are often vaccinated while pregnant with DTaP, influenza, and Hep B vaccines. This information is from the journal Autoimmunity. Aluminum-containing vaccines have been connected to neurological disease, gastrointestinal disease, and autoimmune disease, among others, with symptoms including all of these. The HPV vaccine, also known as the Gardasil vaccine, was licensed in 2006 and pushed on girls as young as 9 years old through fear, claiming it would protect them from deadly cervical cancer, which, by the way, is rare until age 50 and often clears on its own. Gardasil is a growing subject of controversy due to increased rates of ER visits with negative side effects, ranging from fainting, severe headaches, temporary blindness, painful rashes, paralysis, miscarriage, to ovarian failure leading to early menopause, as well as neurological damage, cardiac effects, and death. Many thousands of families are now asking, when will the suffering end? Women who are urged to get the shot are not given the package insert, which says it may not be effective and does not provide protection in cases where women have already been exposed to the HPV virus. And no screening is done to find out. This is medical science. The lead investigator of the study has been vocal, stating that there is no benefit and only risk, since antibody production only lasts 5 years and wanes long before most will be sexually active, and also has many adverse effects. And she's not the only scientist with a warning. In January 2016, 10 years after introduction, the American College of Pediatricians issued a warning letter about the HPV vaccine, stating, one, there's an association between HPV4, the first HPV vaccine, and primary ovarian failure, seen as missing periods. The VAERS database shows amenorrhea and POF, or premature menopause, 88% of which has been associated with Gardasil. And two, the American College of Pediatricians also linked the aluminum adjuvant to autoimmune disease and cited previously documented ovarian toxicity in rats from another component, polysorbate 80. Yet the American Medical Association continues to push the cervical cancer vaccine not only on girls, but now also on boys who do not have a cervix, which is why they prefer to call it HPV or Gardasil, to confuse.
You've been listening for the last 10 minutes to Roseanne Lindsay on why vaccination is not immunization, and she's only citing the peer-reviewed literature out of PubMed, which is the government's official base of legitimate science. Now, we have found, I have spent more than 15,000 hours of research on the question, are vaccines safe and effective? And I have yet to find that they're either safe or effective for any given individual. So I've spoken with a lot of toxicologists, including professors of toxicology, and they will say the same thing. There's no ingredient ever in any vaccine individually, let alone collectively, that they would deem non-toxic. And the Supreme Court ruled that all vaccines are by their nature non-safe. So it's a risk. And then they're telling us about the great rewards. Just speak with all the parents. And that brings me to one final thing before we go to our guest who is standing by. And I just believe that we should be consistent. if we're going to honor all women, that every single woman who makes a statement is honest in telling us the truth, there is veracity to the claims they're making, and we can all argue whether that's true or not, why is it that that same movement has refused to accept a single parent, 2.5 million women who've seen their healthy babies revert back into some form of brain condition from full-spectrum autism to speech delayed development when they've gotten the vaccines? So you mean believe all women when it comes to a sexual allegation? Okay. But don't believe any woman if they challenge their experience on any other topic. It's just, it's hypocrisy at its worst. Anyhow, we will bring you women, scientists, physicians, activists who have done their homework. I know of 5 who've done at least 15,000 hours, I've spoken to them, of research over a number of years, so they're not talking as misinformed, uninformed, or intentionally misguided individuals. They have deep experience. None of them support mandatory vaccination. My guest on the phone right now is from Baltimore is Professor William Eggington, E-G-G-I-N-T-O-M. He is the Decker Professor of Humanities and Director of the Alexander Grass Humanities Institute at Johns Hopkins University. He is also very, very familiar with his, the public is with his critical books. He contributes regularly to the New York Times, Rolling Stone, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and Stanford University's Arcade. His most recent book is Splintering of the American Mind, and it takes a hard look at the neoliberal trends that now dominate our college and university campuses and administrators and have in turn fostered a culture of divisiveness in identity politics and economic and racial inequality and are now eroding our sense of social community and authentic civic participation. Nice to have you with us today.
It's good to be here, Gary. Thank you very much.
After reviewing your book, it seems it might be encapsulated in the idea that higher education has become highly politicized, not universally, but certainly in many instances, and this is adversely impacted not only the culture of university campuses, but also the sharp political divisions that are increasing in student bodies, including inequalities in academic liberalism. And back in the 1960s, made some great contributions, particularly in the creation of various ethnic and gender departments, such as African-American and women's studies, and courses in civil rights, and the emergence of peace and war studies. And the idea was this would strengthen students' sense of civic responsibility. However, in my own opinion, and I'm speaking subjectively, today I see the opposite has become the case. So please begin by summarizing this trajectory of liberalism's good and well-meaning intentions to bring a sense of civics into our colleges and universities and how it is, well, today it has diverged from its original intent and may be contributing to a culture among young adults where intolerance and economic privilege and elitism prevails. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you, Gary. We have the story is in large strokes exactly that one. Up through the 60s and 70s, there were movements on campus to make education more inclusive, both in terms of who was able to come and get a college education, but also in terms of the histories that would be portrayed, that would be explored in history departments, the literatures that would be explored in literature departments, people's experiences, as you cited examples of. This led as far as opening up of new areas of studies. And now these new areas of studies, Black studies, African-American studies, women and gender, have, I believe, in many ways, been extraordinarily beneficial, both to society as a whole, to the underrepresented groups that found new means of expression in those fields, but also to the disciplines themselves. What we had often failed to see in the past was that history includes the history of underrepresented peoples, and literature includes the experience of those who often haven't had the same access to publishing and the same access to representation in the past as certain sectors of our society have. However, what we've the distance that we've come from the 60s and 70s through the 1980s until now has led at times and in certain circumstances to a kind of balkanization, to the extent that rather than literature, philosophy, history being about an inclusiveness of all perspectives such that those perspectives can have meaningful conversations across their not only disciplinary divides, but their experiential and existential divides, we now have come at times, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but at times to a situation where one's particular identity as determined by, for example, race, gender, class, is so all-encompassing that the presupposition is no one else can understand me. If you're not a member of my group, I can't be understood by you. And so I'll give a little example of this. One of my graduate students comes from Italy, but he's come to study Mexican literature, the history of Mexican literature, a great, great tradition and society. And he has spent years and years reading and researching and doing visits to the country of his expertise. And he's recently written a dissertation on that subject, and it's quite brilliant. Well, as a graduate student, he teaches courses as well at Hopkins from time to time. And one of the courses that he put up, which was about modern Mexican culture, I found as it was posted in the halls, graffiti on it. And the graffiti circled his name, pointed out that it was an Italian name, not a Mexican name, and said, "Not Mexican, this is an example of white-splaining." Now, white-splaining, as your listeners may not or may be able to immediately glean, is a version of what's also been called mansplaining, and there's a history to that. It is absolutely true that that in gender dynamics, men often tend to speak to women as and speak for women as if women weren't in the room, and this has been accounted for and explained, and I think we do well to listen to that. White-splaining, similarly, is the idea that whites feel that they have the right to speak and to speak for other people. However, to then take something, a concept like that, and use it to silence someone who has dedicated his life to trying to understand a culture, and then to try and lead other people to understand the experiences of that culture, what does this lead to? Leads to silence and to fear and to an unwillingness to reach across cultural divides, personal divides, and I think that's a shame. And more than a shame, I think it's somewhat indicative of the role and the lack of playing a role that we should be in higher education in particular, and in particular in the humanities or the liberal arts, which is the following. Our society is suffering from an inability of people to speak to each other and to listen to each other right now. I'm not going to say more than at any other time in our history, because historians have been doing the good work of pointing out we've had other divisive times in our history. But given how, given the advantages we have today in this world, we should be much, much better at listening to each other and making the body politic function in an active and progressive way. And largely we're failing to do that. And largely, I would argue, universities are failing to step up to the job of teaching their students the art of active and understanding and empathetic engagement around tough issues. And I do believe that this is one of the trends that has gotten in the way of that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that overview. Let's continue on that thread, because when we look at the sharp polarity and actually disdain between the right and left media, it seems like it's almost impossible to have a democratic dialogue anymore, a civil dialogue. The Senate judiciary hearings on Kavanaugh were simply, in my opinion, a spectacle that took place throughout the country and including on college campuses. And the key is we have to do our independent research. We have to do our own validating if something is right or not. We shouldn't allow our politics or our ideologues and frequently demagogues to tell us what our truths are and then align behind them uncritically as if a mass consciousness is the ultimate truth, when I could show you 1,000 examples where it is not. And that's where we seem to be going on both sides. And a lot of people have simply said, I've had enough of this immaturity. And they become independent and withdraw from those two. And no one pays attention. I mean, no one's paying attention that over 102 million Americans, as of today, I just checked, now consider themselves independent. And when you ask why, almost all at one time belonged to either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And at some point, something changed their mind. And we're not asking these 102 million people, by the way, that's twice as many that are Democrat and Republican registered combined. Why is it that you have withdrawn your energy? What would it take to realign? Is there a possibility to have a new third dimension other than just the two-party system? And we're not even asking the question. We're simply fighting between the two, thinking they represent everyone and all truths, and they don't. But that is one disturbing conservative trend, is being the view that intellectuals and institutions of higher education are the enemy. Why should we not trust university departments and professors from our top colleges? Why is this? It is simply a conservative ideological stance, perhaps due to religious suspicions that campuses are godless, or is there some truth in conservative right-wing perspectives that we're not aware of?
Well, the result, I believe that this trend, which you've accurately noted, of, the shift from this being a large plurality of conservative voters and conservative identified people in the United States not trusting American universities prior to 2016, that shifted to a majority in July, I think, of this year, July of 2017, were cited in a Pew poll as believing that universities were in fact had in fact a negative impact on the way that our country was going. And I think this is extremely troubling, especially since it's not an even break of people along parties. There's definitely a partisan tilt to that. A much smaller group of those who would actively identify as Democratic voters, for example, hold that opinion. And so differences not only in educational attainment are being aligned along political divisions, it's also, as we can see, differences in opinions about the value of university education per se are being aligned. I believe that there is a certain truth to the matter that conservatives don't feel themselves represented on campus. And I think fault for this lies both in a closed-mindedness that we've been, in my previous answer, discussing, but also in a tendency, and this is probably wrapped up in that closed-mindedness and a kind of reaction loop to it, but a tendency, a more recent tendency on the part of those who identify as conservatives to start to reject basic tenets of, for example, science and scientific consensus that make it extremely hard for university professors who should, in principle, be upholding the principles of science and the scientific method to support. So there seems to be, to my mind, in my opinion, a kind of dual reason behind that. And I've seen a shift, and certainly in the days of what you would call classic conservatives like William F. Buckley, mid-century conservatives. He was very, very much to the right of the political spectrum, but he was not an anti-intellectual by any means. He was an extremely educated man who could write beautifully, and yes, and he was very religious at the same time. And I'm someone who also believes, by the way, that the tendency on the left to poo-poo religion has been extremely damaging for progressive politics. Because moderate religious belief in no way should be opposed to social justice. In fact, the very opposite is true. Most moderate religions make the pursuit of social justice one of the key tenets of their work. So, yes, the tendency that you're identifying is very much true. It's lamentable. And I believe there's work to be done on both sides to make universities, and again, to go back to this theme, a place of open dialogue, a place where people of all political stripes can feel comfortable having debates, and certainly to go back to the opening of your question about independence of thought leading to a willingness to be independent in the capital I sense politically, I would certainly always favor people to think independently. Immanuel Kant, who I would taught or intellectual history course that I taught and have on many occasions defined enlightenment as a freedom from one's self-imposed tutelage. And self-imposed tutelage is precisely that. It's being willing to take other people's judgments instead of doing the hard work of becoming an autonomous individual. That means an independent individual who makes decisions based on his own or her own reason. And I think that is one of the greatest things that we can deliver as professors in the liberal arts to our students is the confidence and the tools to think critically and for themselves.
I really appreciate this. We're out of time. I would have added, along with Immanuel Kant, Spinoza, someone that most students in the United States have never heard of, but extremely informed on freedom to express yourself without the fear that you will upset everyone in the process. I want to highly recommend this book because you share several troubling cases at colleges where free speech is being shut down. And we remember the protests against right-wing Breitbart celebrity Milo Yiannopoulos speaking at the University of California at Berkeley. Now, I took the time on a Saturday to 6 hours looking at every one of his YouTube, or as many as I could, his YouTube chats and interviews. And I would love to have debated him because I felt that he was not a true he was more like an intellectual gadfly. But banning him, I would not have done. I don't believe in banning some because I disagree with him. But there are even some more disturbing identity wars on colleges. They're internal, such as students turning against professors and heads of administrations, for example, for the reading assignments in class. Decades ago, I would have never dreamed of doing such a thing. And yet professors are now being forced to be defensive. They can barely teach classes in fear of a backlash from a privileged student who either doesn't personally like the professor or the material being taught. And it's widespread, this culture of intolerance, and it has kind of a faux sense of individual rights that are a hallmark of earlier liberal agendas that they're trying to align with, but no sense of authentic commitment with these earlier ones. So maybe on a future show, if you would, we can discuss that part of the educational system as well.
I would love to. Thank you very much again for this invitation, Gary.
Okay, Professor Wim Eggington, in his new book is The Splintering of the American Mind. Please purchase it. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.